Hello, dear listeners of the podcast From Weak Resistance to Weak Avant-Garde. Today, I have the honor and pleasure to host Marsha Bradfield, who is an amazing feminist art theorist, a practitioner, curator, working at the University of Fine Arts in London.
University of Arts London. Thank you.
Thank you. And sorry for confusing a little bit the name. She has extensive experience with realizing practice, research, and site-specific projects, such as Incidental Futures, touring in the UK, producing future homes and communities, State Modern 2018, and transacting a market of values, Chelsea College of Arts 2015, and more. Her work was shown and produced in multiple countries on all continents, and it's beautiful. You can see the list in the bio under our conversation. So she works with the heritage, I would say, archives of Barbara Stevenys. And her focus, so Marsha's focus, is in the preoccupation of Stevenys' idea of not knowing and John Latham's use of the term incidental, and she enriches databases around creative agency. Her current research, Marsha Bradfield's current research, considers the body as one of the many contexts composing our worlds. She's using her own lived experience of the body to explore incidentality as an attitude, as well as a relation, self-experimentation, Marxist work, which is a tender, slow, enormously varied and riddled with risk. It could also create opportunities for intercultural, interdisciplinary, and intergenerational ways of being and doing. So this is a shortcut of a larger biography of Marsha Bradfield. I would like to add also that you work a lot with students and with universities and academic contexts on the issues of international collaboration, intercultural collaboration, and with gender issues. And this part of your work is also tremendously important, although it's a bit more hidden as being closer to more administrative than purely academic work. But this is a, you know, patriarchal division, I think we both believe, and I believe that all of this work, so the more practical, more teaching related or university building related work is super important as well. So I'm happy to have you. Welcome. And let's start with the first question, which is short but incredibly complex, as we all know. So what is avant-garde for you? Do you have your definitions, your examples, your favorites, you know, cases? Also, a part of the question is whether avant-garde is the notion that we should use only historically or perhaps also for contemporary practice. So the floor is yours.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for the invitation to be thinking about and discussing a really fascinating nexus of different issues, histories, ideas, and so on and so forth. So I think if I walk back in my recollection and I think about my own encounter with theories of the avant-garde, because that's how I initially approached it in the context of art history, which is my first degree. This was absolutely through Peter Broga's work on the theory of the avant-garde from the mid-70s and Clem Greenberg's work on avant-garde kitsch, which was much earlier. It's so fascinating to think about how that was almost coextensive with the historical avant-garde. But I think that this idea of the historical avant-garde was, for me, very stimulating, especially when it became a kicking against point, if we can describe it like that, when I encountered the Chinese avant-garde. So that's when, for me, I was, I think, really galvanized by this idea.
Chinese avant-garde, you're going to have to tell us more about that, because it sounds, I don't even know whether you talk about contemporary or historical art. You know, I have no clue what you might possibly mean, and I'm not undermining the sentence. I'm just saying that I'm lost, also very curious when you say that.
So my own training is in non-Western. That was the term that was used at the time, non-Western art history and world history. And one of the ways that this came together was looking at Chinese history from the early 19th century through until the mid to late 20th century in particular. So really thinking about that window. And what was for me so striking was so many fascinating developments that happened starting in 1919 around the May 4th movement, which was about really challenging a tradition of Confucian ideology and rule in China that was related to the imperial dynasties, thinking about alternatives, and then how that was reconfigured through the Kuomintang, through the nationalists who fled to Taipei, to Taiwan in 49, and the communists taking over, through the Cultural Revolution, so 66 to 76, and then how it was that artists were reflecting on that and making sense of it in the late 70s and in the 80s. So for me, the Chinese avant-garde, we can really think about it specifically in relation to an exhibition that is conveniently called China Avant-Garde. And that took place in February of 89.
Okay. Interesting moment also.
Mm-hmm. Exactly right. It's so fascinating because it was actually about these artists who were grappling with the individual impact of ideology, if you will, but this had bubbled up through all kinds of different scenes throughout across China. And this exhibition took place at the Beijing National Art Gallery. So in some ways, you might think it's very conventional because it's a big group show at a major state institution. But it was also very distinctive because it broke with so many traditions, and crucially, it closed within 2 hours of opening. And what was really important about this closure is that it was a consequence of the work by a particular artist. And the artist's name is Xiao Lu. And essentially, she had a work called Dialogue, which was composed of two telephone booths with figures in these booths. And at the opening of the exhibition, she walked in with a gun and she shot these two booths. And that, of course, resulted in mass chaos and the exhibition was immediately closed. So I guess I'm really fascinated by the idea that on the one hand, this is this heroic gesture, but on the other hand, I think it is useful to understand it in relation to other kinds of complexities. For instance, it's recognized retrospectively as the first shot of Tiananmen Square. So in relation to that, it's quite modest, but very catalytic.
Yeah.
And of course, it is important because Xiao Lu was also really grappling with what it meant to be a woman artist in a very masculinist context. And as she reflects on later, she fled to Australia and made a life there. One of the things she talks about is the fact that this was really about a dialogue that had broken off with a senior person in her world who was responsible for her well-being while her parents were busy doing other things and had actually been quite abusive. And so as a result, when she challenged this person, my understanding is he hung up on her. So this notion of the dialogue with these telephone booths, and between them was this telephone, red telephone, that was off its hanger, is really interesting.
This is an
impression of avant-garde practice.
I think this is an incredibly interesting case altogether, because the few topics, major topics that come up to my head when I listen to this story from you now, is first of all the relations between artistic avant-gardes, classical artistic avant-gardes, so the Russian ones specifically, but also those practiced in Western Europe, in Switzerland, the efforts to build even the MoMA in New York. There is a relation, a very tight relation, a very tender relation, I think, between avant-garde artists and instituting. They all want to create, and the state, especially in Russia, they want the state to take care of arts and cultural production in order to sublate, I would say, the distinction between art and the living world and social world. And they want the institutions to be a major part of it. So basically, this idea of like entrusting the state with art is somehow, you know, is somehow practiced but also challenged by this artist whose work you just described. So I think the relation artist, art, institution, the social is incredibly interesting here. Another layer of what I'm hearing is the making of personal experience becoming the political one. So the classic feminist and Marxist also scenario of taking a particular experience, a painful, traumatizing experience of abuse, of repression, extraction possibly, and making of it a sort of canvas for the world's exploitative sort of rule. And then the third part of the story is that, interestingly, this woman managed to escape to Australia. You know, you would expect, I mean, knowing everything about China that we know in the Western countries, knowing about repression, you know, war, labor camps, all those things that are very attached to our knowledge of China, I think, and they are emblematic. So hearing the story of this, because I imagined her fate to be either in, you know, in criminal case and 150 years of imprisonment in some Chinese gulag or something. You know, I come from Poland. I am one of those people who had this quite stereotypical or quite uniform vision of China as a repressive state. And then suddenly you tell me that this person who did such a groundbreaking but also somehow dangerous work managed to escape the country and have a life in another country not very far away. That's kind of interesting for me also as a story explaining how China is a particular country where, you know, what we might see in Western categories as extreme repression somehow also meets quite unique freedoms that we, or at least me, I don't have the notion, the conceptual tools to actually address. So there is a certain Western centrism in my perspective on that I discover now. And I'm sorry for it, but at least I admit it, which I hope makes it a little bit better. But so where do we go from here? One context is this institution, another is this private personal, becoming political. Let's go in one of these two, maybe, if you want.
Well, I think the first thing to say for the sake of clarity is that Xiao Lu was jailed for 4 days. So it wasn't 40 years. And I think it was symbolic, and it also coincided with Chinese New Year. And so there's a lot there to be thinking about in terms of, I guess, the response of the authorities. And you're quite right to highlight how significant authority is in shaping the Chinese avant-garde, but also Chinese artistic practice since, well, the dawn of thinking about the dynastic regime all the way through until, of course, the current situation. So, and then this comes on to the point about the diaspora, which I think is absolutely essential in terms of thinking about contemporary avant-garde practices, if we can talk about them from the perspective of instituting and thinking about alternative ways of being together that are informed by certain non-Western traditions, if this language is even useful anymore. But I think what I want to alight on is your point about the relationship between the private and the public, if you will, because certainly that is something that Xiao Lu has talked about in relation to this work. The fact that, you know, for instance, in China, you didn't have any private phones. You actually literally had to go to a phone booth to make calls, and then the consequences of that in terms of your own lived experience. But for me, this point about dialogue is really important. And this in some ways gets us into the notion of contemporary avant-garde. And I think we can move from Clem Greenberg and Peter Broger and Berger, and then thinking into Grant Kester's work around conversation pieces, which specifically took aim at the notion of shock value and the avant-garde, and was arguing for something that was much more relational. And as a consequence, was really about these day-to-day interactions and valuing the interpersonal as a creative context and space of possibility. And I think this, for me, really importantly shifts the conversation from producing avant-garde artworks or works of art to this idea of culture, cultural production. And I think that that for me is important in relation to understanding what weak avant-gardism might be today. And then this brings me to this emphasis on the idea of shifting. I think many of us feel, certainly in London, that our institutions are really struggling. They're exhausted. They are really, I think, this question of relevance is up for grabs. And in terms of how the New World Order is emerging, really thinking about alternatives to the star system, which is, of course, fascinating from the perspective of the historical avant-garde and then the weak avant-garde. And even thinking about this idea of sort of weakness, how?
I'm going to jump in here, and I'm sorry for cutting through your last words. I was thinking a lot about the stardom when I was comparing very recently, actually since 10 years, I've been comparing in my thoughts, Marta Rosler and Marina Abramović, and specifically the way they entered the Museum of Modern Art in New York, because they both had the chance to have solo exhibitions. Marina Abramović much bigger and longer than Marta Rosler, but still, and it was, I think, within 2 years that they did it. So first there was Marina Abramović with the artist is present, an incredibly, incredibly, incredibly baroque, but also kind of, you know, I compare it in my article that I'm trying to publish now. I'm comparing it to coronation, basically, or beatification, the Vatican, you know, celebration of, you know, of making somebody a saint, basically. It's a very complex procedure, a very baroque one. You also collect the miracles made by the person. So the person cannot become a saint in Vatican Catholic thinking without miracles. So I think what I saw in this show of Marina Abramović was basically her fantastic monumental figure, plus all those relics and, you know, and miracles, traces of miracles made possible by and visible by reenactment of her performances, sometimes with her former partner, sometimes not. So anyways, there was this monumental exhibition. And then we have Marta Rosler, who brings in a garage sale. And of course, the critics were totally somehow very disappointed. I think that this was the show of Marta Rosler that maybe was met with the least enthusiasm, you know, and the biggest amount of kind of regret. Because first of all, why would she stage another garage sale? The critics were saying on multiple occasions in multiple magazines and journals, she already did that. But yeah, she did it in a small gallery in San Diego, then in some bigger gallery in Switzerland, you know, not in those major places. And suddenly she gets the MoMA New York for her own show and she puts a garage sale in there. And I think it's important. So firstly, actually for me, it was important that she had some tryouts, that she had some rehearsals for this. And then she could really make this garage sale very fluent. You know, she knew very well how to situate it in this monumental space. Also, apparently, the main room was the highly monumental and criticized for being too monumental performance space in the at the MoMA gallery. So she picked a specific, you know, site to do this deconstruction, I would say, of the gallery. But somehow she was the least monumental that I can imagine. Also, I watched other shows, individual shows by women, by feminists, by whoever I could, and somehow this modesty of this show and this everydayness, but also the relationality, precisely. It's like lots of conversations that have to happen when we have a garage sale. So apart from, you know, ridiculizing the value production at art centers, which is at MoMA really like the biggest thing, so laughing at capitalism to some extent, she was also, I think, allowing the dialogue to happen, the everyday, the very mundane, very common, in both senses, common as something that we share, but also common as something that is such a simple activity, you know, not exceptional, unexceptional activity. So she allowed all this. And I'm thinking that the deheroization of avant-garde is maybe for me the most important or the most visible characteristics in my efforts to turn from avant-garde or even neo-avant-garde into the weak avant-garde. This is precisely that. It's like this artist as hero, superhero, you know, some superman or superwoman ceases to exist in favor of some ordinary, more ordinary person with more ordinary abilities, even if they have a gun. But, you know, in the United States of America, for instance, having a gun is very ordinary. I don't know about China, but, you know, there are places in the world where you could say guns are also quite a common piece of equipment. So I'm thinking about the weak avant-garde, first of all, from this perspective of taking it away from the heroic, but also taking it away, so taking art practice away from the exceptional and from the uncommon, miraculous, you know, glorious or whatever. And so all those practices that use ordinary activities, everyday activities, they somehow are related with the dialogue. There are not many. Go ahead.
I think absolutely. And let me alight on that point that you're making. I think certainly for me, I can draw a line in terms of my own work from dialogue as an artwork in this important exhibition by this female Chinese artist, Xiao Lu, all the way to my doctoral research on dialogic art. So I think that resonates with me for many reasons. I think we would not want to make the mistake of suggesting that Martha Rosler isn't an art star. Martha Rosler is an art star, and this work is certainly has a particular kind of reputational value that fortifies that position. So if we think about the work itself, though, you're right to say that it's fascinating to focus on the idea of our stuff, negotiating our stuff, recirculating our stuff, and how that happens through certain conventions like garage sales. I think it is absolutely right and proper to focus on those kinds of everyday activities, those interactions that are also about value production and negotiation, crucially. What does this stuff mean to us? And how do we broker that on an interpersonal level? That is very resonant with work I've done around, for instance, community markets and how we can appropriate that form of socialization and strip away the profit making as in money to understand it as a space of learning and knowledge exchange and mutual validation and valorization and so on and so forth. So there's a lot to say about that. I do also think that this point about value has to be front and center when we're talking about weakness, because one of the exceptional, for me, problems with the exceptional artist is that they deny the fact that they need to make a living. And so this idea of how it is that we have the means to biologically reproduce ourselves, socially reproduce ourselves, consume, and then recirculate through certain conventions like garage sales, to me, relates to weakness in important ways. And then this brings me on to the work that I've been doing around incidentality and the artist placement group. And so I would like to make a case for this being an expression of weak avant-gardism, because it's saying that actually this notion of the artist as worker who needs to earn money cannot be separated from the artist as critical cultural producer stroke creator. And actually, the mistake we've made historically is to suggest that these are distinct through things like art education. And instead, the artist placement group is about placing artists beyond the studio in what historically, in the 1960s, when it was hatched by Barbara Stravini, in what was called industry. So thinking about the factory, for instance, and today we can think about this in terms of other industries like healthcare. We can also think about it in terms of government. But the whole point is to say that actually this idea of separating out work that is about earning a living wage and creative work actually is such a limitation. And so it's not about, I think this is what's really important, is that if we think about, for instance, the theory of the avant-garde, dissolving art into everyday life, the problem with that is that it becomes invisible to the point of being insignificant. I think what I'm interested in from the perspective of the artist placement group is this logic of and also. So it's simultaneously not art, and it is art. And these things are coextensive within the context of the placement. And to just highlight, this is part of a much bigger, I don't want to call it a movement, because I think then we get trapped in certain avant-gardist ideas that are outdated now. I think it's better to describe this as a network of family resemblances, different practices that enjoy a lot of kinship. And I'm thinking about, for instance, a post-artistic practice, Kuba Schroeder, and all the fascinating work that's happening specifically in Poland, but also beyond, thinking about this in terms of usership. This is thinking that has been evolved by Stephen Wright and others, thinking about this in terms of art util, Tanya Bergera's work, and the notion of the office of useful art. So this idea of having offices of art, which then brings us back to the relationship between administration, if you will, and then also the reproduction of art, and how those things can't be separated out either. They're always in dialogue.
I have one question. Maybe it is going to be the last question for this recording. I hope that we can continue the conversation in some other episode, but I believe that for this one now, this should be the last question due to the length of the episodes, basically. The question comes, was somehow inspired by what I've been reading and also discussing with Angela Dimitrakaki, our colleague from working at Edinburgh University, who spoke and wrote extensively about how disappointed she is with the sort of, on one hand, an insufficiently critical versus capitalism, but on the other hand, also insufficiently safe for the art workers themselves. Ideas of precarity and kind of short-term lived projects. I forgot the proper word in English right now, but you know what I mean, this kind of immediacy and only short-term networking, as opposed to the long-term, you know, work in unions, in creating, you know, longer networks. And so I believe, I mean, knowing your practice and knowing your engagement also with the art scene, I know that what you do has a very long perspective sort of embedded in it. And I don't think you believe in, like, as much as you prize the event and the immediacy in certain forms. I think what you have been doing proves very much that you want to see a longer perspective, a long durée within the transformation of the art field from this like shiny fetishist almost distinction between work and art into a more systemic perspective on art as a sector of production and enthusiasm and all these values within it rather than extrapolated somewhere else. But I'm thinking about this long term. So how, within your theorization, within your practice, how would you describe the sort of long term perspective? Or whether, or do you even think we are allowed to project this kind of thing, first of all? But yeah.
Well, I think you're getting into questions of scale that are very context specific. What I will say is that the initiative that I've been involved in, Incidental Unit, is the third iteration of the Artist Placement Group. That dates back to 1965, but it was co-founded by Barbara Stravini. Now, the Incidental Unit has been going for 10 years. It is a self-organized, unfunded, open initiative that is really not about high visibility. It's about meaningful interaction at the level of what might be described as a scene or a community. And so I think in terms of sustainability, it feels to me that that's where we can really look to be fortified, is through these relationships. And crucially, these are not closed networks. So it's also the case that we don't have the energy to go out and evangelize. And it's not necessarily the right and proper thing to do, is to always be radically open, because it feels to me as though it's about pulsing between different modes of being. And I think that this goes also to the long term, is that it's about the energy, isn't it? Yeah. You know, the energy comes together in particular moments, and then additionally it is reconfigured and finds alternative form.
I'm thinking also of the concept of transversality, which is incredibly important for my thinking about weaknesses, because my friend coded me as like professor of weaknesses, and I sort of embrace it very much. So in Weak Resistance already, I was thinking about, you know, Felix Guattari's conceptualization of transversality as the necessary element of any radical social transformation, so including the art worlds and inclusion of some of its aspect within the perspective of labor as well. And I think that in Polish, in our experiences with Kuba Schroeder, with Sebastian Cichocki, also with lots of also feminist artists, there is this tendency to sometimes jump in closer collaborations with institutions, especially if those institutions are sort of open to it for all kinds of political, economic, and other reasons. So in the work of Kuba Schroeder, I think you could see some periods where he's closer with institutions, or even his projects are part of institutional curriculum. And then there are moments, especially when the right wing takes over, I think, when it's more NGO and informal networking that happens. And I think it's kind of like, I take Kuba Schroeder as example, but I could speak of my own engagement with institutions or also against institutions sometimes as an example of this kind of, you know, so if you look at my work, for instance, you have this period of anti-censorship working, which was very much outside or even against institutionalized contexts of art production because we were criticizing censorship. But then I got a grant from Ministry of Culture and I was writing about censorship. And then I was invited by Zachęta Gallery to have a big conference with all different European censored feminist artists. It was very beautiful, you know, one after another. They were entering this beautiful classical, you know, neoclassical stage in this beautiful conference room, and they were saying, yes, I am a convicted criminal, or I had a criminal case which luckily for me didn't end up in conviction, but it might have very well. So for me, this kind of, you know, there is certain level of recognition that institutions can grant that is more empowering and more intense and also sometimes financially more interesting, let's say, than the informal networks. So for me, a choice was always to also use those opportunities and to become partner with the institutions in those instances when they can grant, for instance, a proper recognition to an artist who was persecuted for 10 years in multiple criminal court cases. So then suddenly for her, the valuation that she gets while entering this room full of activists, let's not confuse the things, you know, it was still, so it's a mix of like anti-institutional, a-institutional and institutional contexts that provide certain recognition, but also certain funding and stability and visibility that is needed for those artists, for instance, to show that even after 10 years of persecution, they are still making amazing work. And they survived, but also they had depression, you know, they can talk about it, and some people are going to listen to it and see it. So those amplifying aspects of institutional work are interesting for me also as a resource, but also as an opportunity to enter into dialogue with the institution and to transform it into something different. Because obviously after this censorship event, this institution was a different place. You could tell it that this experience of encountering all these persecuted artists has transformed also, I think, the workers of the institution, who, by the way, never have been censoring themselves. In Zachęta, it was quite emancipated circle of people. So I'm wondering whether to your, in your perspective, this kind of collaborations with the institutions also using those traditional values as visibility or resources, or, you know, like those classical things that we often contest in institutions and in art work. But, you know, so using the stardom kind of situation also to empower those people and those groups and those artistic practices that have been completely excluded and persecuted. Do you think it's like ethically correct or politically reasonable, or would you step out of this and be like, no, we should provide our own recognition systems or something?
I'm very pragmatic, so I think it can be, if we have the right conditions, the possibility, great. But the reality is that the vast majority of artists are never going to enjoy institutional recognition. And it's not because they're not great practitioners doing fascinating things. It's simply because we have a winner takes all scenario and the attention economy is such that it's extremely limited. Let us close with a quote that featured in Barbara Stravinsky's retrospective, because it goes to this specific issue. So here you have somebody who was operating outside of the institution through the deeply interpersonal for literally decades, and posthumously enjoyed a major celebration of her life and work just this year at Modern Art Oxford. And the very first...
Congratulations, by the way, dear.
Thank you so much. The very first page of the reader accompanying this exhibition includes the following. So this is Barbara speaking in from her work, I Am an Archive. My own path in this history has hitherto registered as virtually invisible, hidden behind both the artists involved, predominantly male, and the organizations themselves. So I think in that encapsulation, we get a very clear understanding of the challenges that the majority of artists face, and this is only intensified when one has a practice like Barbara's that is about creating cultures and about recognizing others. So I guess I want to finish today by advocating for a different kind of creative practice that is always about the 50-50, really thinking about the individuals, specifically underrepresented voices, and crucially, thinking about the communities that have supported them in becoming and the enormous interdependence amongst all of these different authorial forces.
I love this closure of this conversation and also the quotes that you gave. And I have a tremendous respect also for you and your work on precisely making this exhibition in Oxford happen. And I would like to add to what you just said, that for me, the weak strategy is also a strategy of kind of, you know, entering with the weakness that we have, with the powerless that we have, into the institutional context and making the institution sort of, you know, maybe even having no choice other than embracing this weakness and powerlessness and lack of recognition and sort of transforming it into something different. So this transformation, I think, this dialogue that we might maintain with the institution can bring, I think, and has given, as in the case of the exhibition you just mentioned, significant change in the perspective also on the excluded group. So thank you so very much, Marsha. I'm going to stop the recording.
One final point, Keith, don't stop the recording yet. I just have to underscore that my contribution to Barbara's retrospective was very weak. So I didn't curate it. I simply was part of many enthusiasts, including Incidental Unit. And this is the third iteration. This is her legacy project. And this is something I would be delighted to discuss with you on another occasion. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so very much.